Talking Books on News Talk 106 to 108.
That was one of the questions I started waking lines with, because I thought, okay, so this man, he's a doctor and he saves life and he's really trying to live his life as a good man. And what defines him more? Like the entire life he lived so far, all the times that he helped an old woman to cross the street, all the, I don't know, the money he gave to charity. Is that the definition of who he is? Or is the definition of who he is lays exactly in that moment when he decides to leave this man who looks differently, who's from another origin, another nationality? And maybe this decision that the doctor is making to commit the hit and run and to leave the person there, maybe it's just one decision, but this decision is like, you know, it's like the DNA that keeps the entire human body in one cell, because this is the essence of who he really is. And I think that for me, that was one of the questions I wanted the reader to ask himself. Like, is it possible that this one decision that somebody makes in a wartime or late at night and when he drives a car is the decision that defines who he is?
No one knows another person completely. There's always a blind spot. The compelling words of Israeli novelist, screenwriter and psychologist Eyalet Gundar-Goshen, taken from her second novel, Waking Lines, published by the Pushkin Press. Hello, how are you? And you're very welcome to Talking Books. I'm Susan Cahill. It's great to have your company this evening. Well, on tonight's show, we're going to travel to Israel, Iran and further afield and meet with some exciting writers and thinkers from the Jewish and Arab world. Israeli novelist Eyalet Gundar-Goshen unpacks her gripping new thriller, Waking Lines, and why Israeli fiction needs to explore the dark corners of contemporary life. And Peter Adamson from the History of Philosophy podcast unpacks the impact of Islamic philosophy and mysticism on the Western world. This is a show about fear, discrimination, insight and survival. But first, can we understand everything?
I'm Peter Adamson. I'm professor of late ancient and Arabic philosophy at the LMU in Munich, Germany. So I'm a professional philosopher, but I'm also a producer of a podcast called the History of Philosophy podcast, which launched several years ago in 2010 and has been looking at the entire history of philosophy without any gaps since then.
Peter, really well done on the book and also on the podcast. Incredibly impressive. I might just throw you in the deep end, but after all, you're a philosopher, so you're used to this type of stuff. Do you believe in the idea of perfect understanding? It's something that you do develop in the book.
I guess I don't believe in that. So what I believe is that you can have a kind of understanding of the questions, and you can advance gradually through philosophical questions and see the merits and demerits of answers. But I don't think that we'll ever, as it were, get philosophy done and figure out all the answers to all the questions we have.
As I was leafing through philosophy in the Islamic world, it struck me to some degree that philosophy is somewhat Eurocentric. Because when we think of some of the great philosophers, there's always the Greeks come in, we throw in a few Dutch and Italian and French, the odd Brit or two. But we forget our brothers in the Arab Jewish world, don't we? Our brothers and sisters in the Arab and Jewish world.
Yeah, and not just there. I mean, the teaching of philosophy and the history of philosophy in the English-speaking world, I mean, first of all, you just said brothers and sisters. I was going to say that too. So first of all, it almost never covers female philosophers from before the 20th century. So that's one complaint I would have. But another complaint I would have about the way history of philosophy is taught is that it is very Eurocentric. I mean, if you think about the figures who are standardly covered in undergraduate teaching of philosophy, you're thinking about Plato, Aristotle, Augustine, Aquinas, Descartes, Spinoza, Leibniz, Kant. I mean, basically all European men. Obviously, these are all great philosophers, but one of the things I've been trying to do in the podcast series is direct attention towards other philosophical cultures. To some extent, that was natural for me to do because my own area of research includes Islamic philosophy. So in a way, actually, I kind of got into the podcast by thinking, well, if I start with ancient philosophy, then I'll go on to Islamic philosophy and maybe the audience will stay with me. So it was kind of a plan from the beginning to cover Islamic philosophy. But something that is branched out into that I wasn't planning to do originally was Indian philosophy. I have a co-author named Janardhan Ganeri, with whom I've been doing episodes on Indian philosophy since last year. So that means I've looked at European philosophy up to the Middle Ages, Islamic philosophy and Indian philosophy, and in the future I'm going to do African philosophy with another co-author, and maybe eventually I'll do Chinese philosophy. We'll see.
What does the word or discipline of Kalam mean to you? It's rational theology, isn't it?
Yeah, I usually translate it as rational theology or Islamic rational theology. The word kalam literally means word, and the sort of full phrase is ilm al-kalam, which means knowledge of the word or science of the word. And this is just the expression they use for theology in Islamic culture. It's actually not quite clear why they do that, maybe because it's the study of the word of God or, you know, God's word as in the Quran, but there's other explanations even in the medieval period about why it's called that. So an interesting question, which is actually very hotly debated among scholars of philosophy in the Islamic world, is whether we should think about theology, so kalam, as they called it, as part of the history of philosophy, or whether we should think about philosophy in opposition to kalam. This is a difficult question because
Interesting question, though, isn't it?
Yeah, it's interesting, and of course, it's a question you could ask about other cultures too. So one of the arguments that I would have for considering theology in the Islamic world to be part of the history of philosophy is that we unhesitatingly say that theology in the Christian world can be part of the history of philosophy. So just think of Thomas Aquinas. Thomas Aquinas's works, at least his most famous works, are explicitly theological works, but we still teach them in philosophy class. The difference in Islamic culture is that they actually had a very sharply defined distinction, at least for the first few centuries of the tradition, between what they called falsafa, which is apparently philosophy, and so they actually get the word from the Greeks, and they take the Greek word philosophia and turn it into an Arabic word, falsafa. So there's that on the one hand, and then there's this rational theology, kalam, and authors on both sides of that divide see a contrast between the two. And so some people who work in this field think, well, if we're historians of philosophy, then we're only looking at what they called philosophy, falsafa. Other people like me want to have a broader approach where kalam, in other words, Islamic theology, is factored into the history of philosophy insofar as it's philosophically interesting, because we would say, well, there's arguments to be found in kalam texts which are philosophically interesting, so the historian of philosophy should pay attention to them and not just ignore them because it's theology and not philosophy.
Well, arguably, they're all in relationship. I'm just wondering, one of the men that you bring up, or one of the philosophers that you bring up, is Avicenna. And I didn't know much about him. He wrote his autobiography, which was pretty controversial at the time, and he threw out a lot of interesting views. He was a polymath, Persian polymath. Did he change the way we think?
Well, he certainly changed the way they thought in the Islamic world. So really, you could almost divide philosophy in the Islamic world into two parts, one before Avicenna and one after Avicenna, in the sense that after Avicenna, everyone's basically reacting to him the way that, let's say, in modern philosophy, once Immanuel Kant comes along, everyone has to respond to Kant. Or maybe in, you know, economic theory, after Marx, everyone has to respond to Marx and at least factor him in, even if they don't agree with him. So the same thing happens in the Islamic world with Avicenna. Actually, though, his influence goes beyond the Islamic world because his works were translated into Latin and were very influential in medieval scholastic Latin philosophy. You just mentioned also that he's a polymath, which is true. So he also works in science. He writes about mathematics. And alongside philosophy, the one area where he's very influential is medicine. So his medical works were also translated into Latin and became very influential in Christian Europe as well.
Peter, you pitch up a very interesting question in the book. Does philosophy produce beneficial effects? Can we talk about that in relation to the mystics?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. And of course, this is another group of people who you might argue about whether they're part of the history of philosophy or not. And again, I tend to have a broad approach and am willing to say that mysticism is part of the history of philosophy, or at least it can be. I mean, if you think about whether philosophy can have beneficial effects, there's kind of a dispute between mystics and philosophers, or self-styled philosophers, in the Islamic world, and maybe in other cultures as well, between more rational approach, where it's thought that you can achieve happiness or perfection by managing to make yourself ethically virtuous, and also to achieve an understanding of the world. So in their case, they would think about having an intellectual grasp of God, of the created world, and how it's put together. Basically, what that means for them is understanding science, including the science of philosophical theology. Now, mystics will want to say that there is a way of accessing truth that somehow transcends reason, or perhaps transcends anything that we can actually put into words. So they're more likely to resort to metaphors.
Well, let me throw you a bit of Rumi. Don't grieve. Anything you lose comes around in another form. Is that poetry or is that philosophy?
Yeah, so it's both. So Rumi is a great example. I mean, I think there's probably two famous philosophical mystics from the Islamic world. One is Ibn Arabi, who's from Andalusia, from Islamic Spain. The other is Rumi, who you're just quoting, who is super famous. So he's a Persian poet, and you can find his works in pretty much any bookstore in translation. It's, I think, not so obvious, actually, with Rumi, that he's a philosopher. I mean, you have to think hard about how the poems that he's writing relate to the philosophical tradition that he's responding to. But actually, a lot of his ideas are similar to those of Ibn Arabi. So, for example, this idea that actually it doesn't sort of matter so much what happens in your earthly life, because what you should be doing is seeking some kind of union with God, which is kind of the background to the quote you just gave us. That's something that he shares with Ibn Arabi. And again, it's, you can think of him as a mystical author, because the union with God that he's trying to achieve is something that transcends rational discourse. Arguably, one reason why he writes in poetry is that he's trying to evoke this idea of union through poetic metaphor.
I was very interested in some of the stuff you wrote about in relation to Jewish philosophy. And you argue that the use of Arabic was not restricted to Muslims, that Jews were also producing texts. One of them that I found very interesting, and I didn't know much about it, was the Zohar. It's one of the classic Kabbalistic texts. Mm-hmm. Have you read that?
Yeah, sure. So the Zohar is a classical work of Jewish Kabbalah. So this is kind of the analogous thing in Jewish culture to what we were just talking about with the Sufis, who are the Islamic mystics. So you have Ibn Arabi and Rumi and a whole bunch of other mystical authors in the Islamic context. And then in the Jewish context, you have Kabbalah, which is the equivalent mystical tradition. There's maybe some kind of interplay between the two. So probably influence from Islamic Sufism on Kabbalah, although that's somewhat controversial. One thing, though, that I would say in general is that something I was trying to do in the book and in the podcasts on which the book is based is integrate intellectual history of Judaism into the intellectual history of the Islamic world, because a lot of the great Jewish texts were produced in the Islamic culture, for example, by Maimonides, who's probably the greatest figure in the history of Jewish philosophy. So he was born in Islamic Spain. When the political situation got awkward for him and his family, they moved away. He eventually wound up in Cairo, so still in the Islamic world. And he wrote in Arabic as well as Hebrew, which is true of a lot of Jewish philosophers.
What does the Zohar reveal to you, or what do you take from it as a philosopher?
Well, the one thing that I'm interested in by the Zohar or Kabbalah in general is that they're effectively using this sort of language of symbols, like often involving numbers or other technical symbolic words, to express something that to me actually looks very familiar from the history of philosophy, which is something that really derives from Neoplatonism in late ancient philosophy. So basically the idea here is that we have a first principle, which is God, who is beyond our rational grasp, as we were talking about with mysticism before. And then there's a kind of system which explains how things come forth from God in a kind of structured way. So the Neoplatonists talk about emanation. The Kabbalistic texts do this in terms of a kind of numerological scheme. But I think it's basically the same idea. So what you have is the positing of a completely transcendent first principle, and then other things descending from that principle in some kind of more or less ordered way. So what I think is interesting is that Kabbalah is often seen as like this sort of anti-philosophical, completely mystical, anti-rational tradition, but actually has a lot in common with even late Greek pagan ideas about the production of the universe from the first principle. So I think it's interesting to see how these kind of ideas flow through the tradition. And of course, they show up again in the Christian tradition too.
But they're all ultimately talking about self-transformation, aren't they?
Yeah, or even, I mean, you could even think that they're talking about identifying yourself with the first principle, which again is something that we could point to in other cultures. So if you think about Indian philosophy, one of the things I've covered on the podcast recently is the tradition of Vedanta, and especially Advaita Vedanta, which was put forth by a philosopher named Shankara in response to the Vedic tradition. And basically what he says is that you can achieve kind of perfection or of the avoidance of suffering by identifying yourself with Brahman, who's the first principle. And so something that's like an obvious thing to do, that a lot of people do, is look across all these mystical traditions and say, oh, Advaita Vedanta, Kabbalistic mysticism, Sufi mysticism, Neoplatonic mysticism, these are all basically the same kind of idea. And although that's true in a way, because they're all positing a transcendent first principle and maybe arguing that we should identify ourselves with a transcendent first principle, I'm kind of more interested in the differences in terms of how the ideas are expressed, where they came from, what they were responding to. So although that kind of comparative project is interesting, I usually try to talk about each one in its own right rather than looking across the cultures and saying, oh, look, they're all mystics.
I found what you wrote about the Sufis was very interesting in relation to annihilation, mm-hmm. or the idea that we kind of, I think you termed it ecstatic abandonment or something like that. It's pretty profound, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's also very challenging, because what they're essentially telling you to do is give up any value that you might have on anything that is particular to you. So you have to somehow destroy yourself. So this idea of annihilation, you have to destroy yourself in order to achieve union with God. So it's not like, oh, here's me, I'm Peter, and there's God, and the two of us could come to some kind of agreement or see that we have something in common. You know, he's the principle of being, and I have being, so we have something, we share something, which is maybe what a philosopher like Aquinas or Avicenna might say. The Sufis and the Kabbalists, but more the Sufis, I think, at least in the text that I was looking at, what they say is that you have to dissolve yourself into God so that nothing remains. And that's actually a lot more like the Indian idea that I was just describing as well. That's the whole point of Advaita Vedanta.
It sounds very radical, but when you actually think it through, it makes a terrific amount of sense, doesn't it?
Well, it does. I mean, maybe it makes sense if you're a theist, because you might say, well, if I believe in God, then God is the most real thing. Maybe he's even the only real thing, and everything else is only an effect of God, or maybe even an illusion that God has created, although it's not quite clear what the philosophical argument would be for thinking that the world that seems to be real is actually an illusion, which is what a lot of these mystics want us to believe. But whether you're a theist or not, I think it's actually very challenging if you think about it, not so much in terms of annihilating your ego, because that's probably the way you're thinking about it. But think, for example, about the fact you'd have to give up valuing your family members.
Well, I'd look at it more in the area of attachment.
Yeah, right. But attachment doesn't just mean money or my car, right? It could also mean attachment to, for example, the happiness of my children, or attachment to the welfare of my parents or my neighbors. And if you'd really take this idea seriously that the Sufis are putting forward, you have to annihilate everything that is a kind of self-centered value, and that includes your own relationships to, for example, your family members, because if you're annihilated and identical with God, then you don't have any special relationship to your family anymore, right? They, of course, would probably say, that doesn't mean we're going to start being vicious or cruel in our everyday life. It just means that ultimately we're kind of also operating at a higher plane. But I still think it's a kind of radical philosophical proposal that I, in the end, would probably reject, because I do think that it tends to undermine values that I think are real. For example, interpersonal relationships, like the ones I was just mentioning.
Can I ask you about two other guys that I find very interesting in the book? One is Al-Ghazali. You describe him as quite the skeptic. And the other is a guy that you end the book with, Mullah Sandra of Iran, who seemed a very progressive thinker.
Yeah, so they're very different thinkers, actually. For one thing, Al-Ghazali is a great figure in the history of Sunni theology, and Mullah Sadra is a famous Shiite philosopher, theologian. But they're hugely important and influential still in the contemporary Islamic world. So Ghazali is still seen as a major religious authority in Sunni Islam, and Mullah Sadr is still seen as a major religious authority in Iran today. I think one difference between them is that Sadra, who's working much later, like in early modern Iran under the Safavids, he is really considering himself to be heir to the philosophical traditions and to be part of that. Whereas Ghazali, who died in the early 12th century, actually he died in 1111, which is a very good date to remember, or an easy date to remember, he really saw himself as a critic of philosophy, and in particular of Avicenna, who we mentioned earlier. He wrote a work called The Incoherence of the Philosophers, in which he tries to show that a lot of what Avicenna argues in his philosophy is unsustainable and is also in some cases against Islam. But on the other hand, he doesn't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater, and he thinks that some other aspects of Avicenna's philosophy are okay and should be kept. And this kind of sets the tone for subsequent thinkers. So what they tend to do is pick and choose from Avicenna, use some of his theories, agree with some of his ideas, and reject other ideas that he has. So it's actually a very complicated and subtle response to Avicenna. Sometimes Ghazali is just presented as like a forthright, thoroughgoing anti-philosopher, and I think that's really not true.
Last question for you, Peter. The book is called Philosophy in the Islamic World. I'm just wondering, is the beauty in philosophy the gaps, the areas that we can't really fully define, understand, comprehend? Is that not the magic and the majesty of philosophy?
Yeah, I think that's right. That there's always more to figure out. So I would definitely agree with that. That kind of goes back to the first question. But I'm not promising philosophical wisdom without any gaps. I'm just promising the history of philosophy without any gaps. So what's without gaps is the history part, not the philosophy part. And so the goal of the series is really to look at the entire history of philosophy. In other words, not just like the really big names like Plato, Aristotle, Aquinas, Kant, like I was saying before, but to look at other cultures, to look at the role of so-called minor thinkers, or even interesting texts where we don't even know who the author is. That happens sometimes. Like I was saying before, female philosophers who also tend to get left out. So in a sense, what I'm trying to do is give a complete history of philosophy. And as we've been talking about a lot in this interview, a lot of the times what the philosophers are saying is that there are gaps and that we can't understand everything.
Thank you.
And that was philosopher, broadcaster and writer Peter Adamson. Philosophy in the Islamic World is published by Oxford University Press and retails for in around €28 in hardback. Well worth it, I think, for anyone who has a general interest in Islamic culture, thinking and science.
Talking Books on Newstalk 106 to 108.
And you're very welcome back to Talking Books. I'm Susan Cahill. It's lovely to have your company this evening. Okay, let's stick with the theme of morality and ethics and meet with one of the leading lights of Israeli fiction, Eyalet Gundar Goshen.
Hello, my name is Eyalet Gundar Goshen. I'm an Israeli writer. I live in Tel Aviv. I wrote two novels. The first is One Night Markovitch and the second is called Waking Lines. I'm also a clinical psychologist and I worked a period of time for the Israeli civil rights movement. I will now read the first page from Waking Lines. Waking Lines tells the story of Eitan. He's an Israeli doctor. He thinks of himself as a good man. He votes for the liberal left. He's a good father. He's a doctor. He saves lives. And then one night when he drives back home from a late night shift in the hospital, he accidentally hits an Eritrean illegal immigrant. And he decides to leave him there on the side of the road because he's afraid of the police. He's afraid of what might happen. And the next day, the refugee's wife knocks at his door and starts blackmailing him. That's the first page of Waking Lines. He's thinking that the moon is the most beautiful he has ever seen when he hits the man. For the first moment after he hits him, he is still thinking about the moon. And then he suddenly stops, like a candle that has been blown out. He hears the door of the SUV open and knows that he's the one opening it, that he's the one getting out now. But that knowledge is connected to his body only loosely, like a tongue skimming over gums shortly after a Novocaine injection. It's all there, but different. His feet, the desert gravel, and the crunching sound he hears confirms that he is walking. Somewhere behind the next step, the man he hit is waiting for him. He can't see him from here, but he's there. Another step and he's there. He slows down, tries to delay that final step. After which you'll have no choice but to look at the man lying on the side of the road. If only you could freeze that step, but of course he can't. Just as he can't freeze the previous moment, the exact moment he ran him down. The moment a man driving an SUV ran down a man walking on the road. Only the next step will reveal whether that man is still a man or is now something else. The mere thought of the word paralyzes him, because when he takes that last step, he might discover that the man is no longer a man, but the cracked, empty shell of one. And if the man lying there is no longer a man, he cannot imagine what will become of the man standing there, shaking, unable to complete one simple step. What will become of him?
Really well done on the book, Eyalet. It's a fascinating read. It presents so many ethical questions and dilemmas to the reader. And within all of that, it really tests your own moral limits and how you understand the narrative. I might throw you a big wide open question to start off with, if that's okay. Do you think that we can ever know really what our moral limits are until they're finally tested? And within all of that, can we ever say never, never, never?
When I started writing Waking Lands, that was exactly the question I started writing with. Because I asked, okay, so you have your entire life being a good man and you think of yourself as a good man and you vote for the right people for the government and you're very politically involved. But can you really know that you're a good man until that moment happens? Because that's exactly what I asked myself. I asked myself, if it was me driving home late at night and I want to get back to my baby and put her to sleep, and I would run over somebody and there was nobody there, am I absolutely sure, 100% sure, that I wouldn't just leave the person there and go back to my safe life and my regular existence? And I don't think you can ever tell until you're exactly in that moment.
Yeah, it got me thinking in lots of different levels. And while I'm not married and I don't have children, I do have an amazing twin sister with exquisite children. And it got me thinking, what would I do to protect their lives and how far would I go? And, you know, within all of that, you know, the survival instinct kicks in and it is very hard to predict what we would do in any situation, isn't it?
Yeah, I think until the moment you're finally there, you can never tell. I mean, we have this concept of who we really are, of what kind of person we are. And then we judge other people when we read about them in the newspaper, about people who commit hit and runs or people who, I don't know, betrayal on their partners. And we say, I'll never do that. But the thing is that until this moment arrives, when you suddenly meet your fate and you have to make a decision, then you can talk as much as you like. But I think the decision you make is what defines you much more than the words we say. Because words, you know, we say them very easily. But decisions, you take them, and this is what really shapes who you are, the decision you make.
Do you think it's fair, though, to maybe judge any person, man or woman or child, by one really bad decision?
I think that was one of the questions I started waking lines with, because I thought, okay, so this man, he's a doctor and he saves life and he's really trying to live his life as a good man. And what defines him more? Like the entire life he lived so far, all the times that he helped an old woman to cross the street, all the, I don't know, the money he gave to charity. Is that the definition of who he is? Or is the definition of who he is lays exactly in that moment when he decides to leave this man who looks differently, who's from another origin, another nationality? And maybe this decision that the doctor is making to commit the hit and run and to leave the person there, maybe it's just one decision, but this decision is like, you know, it's like the DNA that keeps the entire human body in one cell, because this is the essence of who he really is. And I think that for me, that was one of the questions I wanted the reader to ask himself. Like, is it possible that this one decision that somebody makes in a wartime or late at night and when he drives a car is the decision that defines who he is?
Etienne, your lead protagonist, neurology professor at college, is a very interesting side character in the novel. And we get lots of his insights and advice on humanity and society all sprinkled through the novel. And one of the interesting things he advises his students is, and he says it directly to Etienne, is the only way to know something, Etienne, is to investigate death. Death teaches you everything you need to know. I'm just wondering, as a psychologist and as a writer and having, you know, I'm sure lived through lots of interesting experiences in life. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I think the experience of death is what brings the depth into our everyday existence. I think it is the moment that you realize that things are not here forever is the moment when you start really appreciating what you have. It's like the idea of memento mori in art. That whenever somebody paints a basket full of fruits, they put one fruit which is already deteriorating. And they put it because they want you to remember that all of these fruits will deteriorate eventually. And you appreciate much more, it can be a flower or a person or fruit, if you understand that what is here right now isn't here forever. And I think it makes you appreciate the people you meet or the moments that you have. And especially in medicine, yeah, that's the way we examine stuff. We look at what went wrong. We when we do a surgery of corpse, for instance, you look at what went wrong. And from that, you understand how you should do it to make it right. And for me, I think in the story of Waking Lands, it is only when this doctor is really facing death and death that he himself caused to somebody else, that's the moment when he really starts being alive.
You pitch up a really interesting question in the novel Ailet. You write, what is the price of silence? What is the price of a man's life? And within this novel, the man's life, he's a migrant and he's probably quite invisible in society. And I'm just wondering, do you think in life and do you think in how we're living, whether it's how we're treating our migrant communities or maybe people who are either stateless, that we think that some lives are more valuable than other lives?
I think definitely so. I mean, at least if I talk about Israel, I think, yeah, I think there's a difference between hitting accidentally a Jewish white girl and hitting an unknown man, not carrying any documentation, black, that doesn't speak your language, that doesn't share your culture. I think it's easier to leave somebody on the side of the road if he's from a different origin and different skin and he looks different. I'm ashamed to say so, but I think, yeah, I think Eitan, my protagonist, I'm not sure that he would be able to leave somebody who looks exactly like him, that somebody who could be his best friend, his beer buddy. He is capable of leaving this man because this man is part of the unknown people in the Israeli society, of the people that we'd never bother to look at, that we don't never bother to ask for their names.
Etienne's wife, Liette, is an extraordinary character. She was made for such good reading and such good company. She was very curious and she was smart and very perceptive. Yet when it came to her own husband, she developed quite a sense of paranoia in how she realised that there was some deceit going on, but she wasn't quite clear what it was. And she was aware that she was becoming more and more paranoid and she was checking up on him. And it got me thinking about relationships, when sometimes we guess something is wrong, but it may not be personally directed at us, but we can go down dark roads fairly fast and think our husband or our partner has a lover, or we can assume things that are personal to us that not necessarily are, can't we?
Yeah, I think what was interesting for me in the ad is that she's a police investigator, so she's really good at seeing stuff and noticing stuff. And here she's completely blind. She can't notice the fact that her own partner is the one that committed the hit and run that she's investigating. And the question was why? I mean, how come a woman that works in looking into people and finding the truth, how can she be so blind? And the thing is that I think that in order to be able to have a relationship for a long time, you have to maintain a certain amount of blindness. And this is her blind spot. And even when she starts being more suspicious, then she can suspect a love affair, for instance, or she's afraid that he might be cheating on her. But she can't even start to imagining him hitting a migrant and leaving him there in the side of the road, because that would be saying that the man she loves is unknown to her, that he's capable of things that she could never imagine. And I think in order to stay in love for so many years, you have to be, in a way, a bit blind for the person you live with.
It's such an interesting area, because there are blind spots in love, but I'm sure in all sorts of, in lots of different people's lifetimes, they've laid in bed beside someone who's done lots of different things that they're completely unaware of. And then they wake up one day and it is a stranger in bed based on what they've done, isn't it?
Exactly. And the idea that the person you're lying so close to, the person that you know his smell, you know his body by heart, you can recognize him in a dark room, and you think you know everything about him, but you know nothing about him. And I think it's a very disturbing thought about our partners, but it's also a very disturbing thought about ourselves. Like when somebody wakes up in the middle of the night from a dream and he's afraid of his own dreams. And if somebody asks you, what were you dreaming about? Then you lie and you say, I don't remember. I'm really interested in this moment where something that is within us, it's inside our mind, frightens us so much that we can't talk about it with anybody else, because we feel as if it's foreign to us, though it's not. It's the most intimate part of ourselves.
Can you describe Circe? She is the third main character in the novel. She's Eritrean. She's one hell of a survivor. She's tough. She's resilient. She's intelligent. She's a great improviser. It's hard to make a reading on her in terms of, is she all good or is she all bad? So can you describe her and what you were trying to do with her as a character?
Circe, she's the wife of the illegal migrant that Eitan has run over. And she knocks at Eitan's door the next day and she starts blackmailing him to give medical treatment to the Eritrean community that lives in the Israeli desert, and they're afraid to get to the hospitals because they're afraid of getting arrested and kicked out of Israel. And the thing was that she starts as this sort of, I don't know, angel doing this very moral thing, like blackmailing him to help people from her community. But very soon we find out that she has other interests in mind and she has secrets of herself. And that was very important to me when I wrote her, because I didn't want her to be this black angel, black Madonna, you know, this picture of a saint. I didn't want her to be this refugee woman, noble refugee woman, because I feel in a way this is dehumanizing to say that she's only good or that she's only a victim or only altruistic. And I think in order for her to be a real human being, a real character, then she has to be capable of doing good things as well as bad things, of taking care of people as well as betraying them and cheating them and putting them under huge risk.
It's a compelling storyline that you've written, Eilish, and there's so much force and energy within it. But aside from that, it presents a very unequal Israel. It presents a very murky side to the social politics of Israel. Parts of it make for very uncomfortable reading. I'm just wondering, how did middle class Israel understand your novel and what you said in it? So I'm just wondering how it's gone down.
Well, when the book was published, one of the most interesting things one of the journalists told me was that he found himself hoping that Eitan will get away with it. And he said, I stopped and I asked myself, how come I want the bad man to get away with it? How come I want him to finish the novel not being caught by the police? I mean, he's the man who did a hit and run with the Eritrean. I should want him to be arrested so that, you know, justice will be done. And this journalist told me, well, I want Eitan to get away with it because Eitan is like me. I'm this middle-class man, this white man that votes liberal left and thinks of himself as a good man. And I want my safe existence to remain safe and untouched in a way. So I think Waking Land's reception in Israel was exactly this, that you ask yourself, do I want this person to pay for his sins? Do I want this person to be forced to look at those people who we usually treat as invisible, the migrants or the lower part of society? Or do I want him to keep with his safe everyday life? And for me, that's the question as a writer and as a reader.
I've traveled all around Israel and all through Palestine, and it got me thinking that maybe we don't get enough of these points in our fiction from those parts of the world.
Well, I think, in a way, people who don't know Israel, never visited Israel, think that the only people who live in Israel is Israelis and Palestinians killing each other. And I think that there is more into more layers in society and more complexity than that. And as a writer, I wanted to write a story that deals with a story people usually don't talk about, which is the huge issue of the immigrants coming right now from Eritrea and from Sudan to Israel. I think it's a major problem here, because you think about the fact that we Israelis are a nation of refugees, and we walked the same desert they're walking right now. We walked this desert in the Exodus and then the mythology of the people of Israel walking out of Egypt trying to reach the promised land. And right now we have the Eritreans and the Sudanis walking the same desert trying to reach the promised land, but we are now the gatekeepers.
But it's a major problem all over the world on how we're treating our migrant populations and seeing them as outsiders, and how we're possibly forgetting that all nations to some degree had to leave or were in exile or moved on to different lands. So in ways, the story here is quite a universal one.
Yeah, definitely. I think in this way, Waking Lands is about a doctor committing a hit and run. But you can say that the first world is committing a huge hit and run right now, because we know what's going on in the world. And the question is, do we open our doors to those people and we let them in, or do we keep the doors shut? This is a war of civilization, or a clash of civilization, just like the hit and run in the novel.
Lastly, I'm just wondering how psychology and being a practicing psychologist, how that lends into the writing process. And do you think it gives you an added advantage in some way?
Well, I feel there's a very big resemblance between writing and doing psychology, in the sense that it's not about judging the characters or the people you meet. It's about trying to understand them. So instead of saying, this is a bad man because he did a hit and run, I don't have the privilege of just saying, this is a bad man. I have to say, okay, but why? Or what is it in all of us that would enable us to do the same thing? I have to try to understand him from within, rather than watch him from outside and just say, oh, he's good or he's bad. And I think when you meet patients, it's the same. It's like somebody comes into the room and tells you a story, tells you about something that he did. And the immediate response is to judge people, to say, this is a bad man, this is a good man. But when you practice either writing or psychology, it's not about judging those people. It's about asking, okay, why? What made this person do what he did? What makes somebody do what he does? And what makes people change? I mean, could it be that the person who did this thing and came to my clinic to confess would eventually do something completely else? Which is the same question of Waking Lions. Okay, so he made this decision, but does this decision define him for the rest of his life, or can he make other ones?
And that was Israeli novelist Eilat Gundar Goshen. Waking Lines is published by Papushkin Press and is available in all good bookshops for in around €11 in paperback or off the Papushkin Press website. Well, that's it for Talking Books for another week. I hope you enjoyed the show. All that's left for me to do now is to say a big thank you to Ronan Brannock, who helped out with this week's programme, and the lovely Lee Duncan on sound. We've been Talking Books. I'd like to end tonight's broadcast with the consoling and beautiful words of the great Muslim philosopher, theologian and mystic Al-Ghazali, who once advised, "The happiness of the drop is to join the river." Good night.
Talking Books on News Talk 106 to 108.